It's another beautiful Sunday afternoon here in Asheville, North Carolina. You're listening to Wordplay. I'm your host, Jeff Davis. With me today in the studio, Hickory poet Scott Owens. Scott's a graduate of the UNCG MFA program, he co-editor of Wild Goose Poetry Review, chair of the Sam Reagan Poetry Prize for the Poetry Council of North Carolina, and the author of Musings, a weekly poetry column and outlook. He's also the author of 4 collections of poetry and over 400 poems published in various journals, including Georgia Review, North American Review, Dead Mule, Chattahoochee Review, and the Beloit Poetry Journal. He's been nominated for 2 Pushcart Prizes and a Best of the Net Prize. He was born in Greenwood, South Carolina, but he now lives in Hickory, North Carolina, where he teaches and coordinates the Poetry Hickory reading series, which is a fine series. So, how did you come to writing, Scott?
How did I come to writing? That's a tough question. I had always been good with language, I suppose. When I was young, didn't talk much. Still don't talk much, to be honest. But I listened a lot, and I loved reading, and I figured out fairly early on that I could get some positive attention through my writing. Which, given most of my childhood, any source for positive attention was a good thing.
Yeah, a big
And at some point, I started... So most of my very early writing was just stuff to get approval. And it was a game that I was good at, but it was still just a game. At some point, I started writing other things that were more personal, more significant. And for the most part, I kept those to myself. And sometime in my late teens, I think I had an experience that kind of made me feel a sense of obligation to begin sharing those more personal and significant writings. And so I guess I'd say that was probably the beginning of seeing myself as someone who was a writer in that sense of the word, rather than someone who was just creating pieces of work that other people approved of.
Uh-huh. So you started writing quite young. Together.
Right. I mean, I don't know, maybe I think I probably wrote my first poem in fourth grade, and it was a little thing that probably every fourth grader is required to write some kind of poem for their mother on Mother's Day, and the school that I was at, they nominated one for some sort of an award, and mine won the award, and that was kind of the indication, oh, gee, I'm actually pretty good at this, and so I kept doing it, and year after year had kind of the same story with whatever opportunities arose to write something, I would write something, and I typically won the prize or was given an opportunity to share it with people. But like I say, it was all just sort of the, I'm writing what people wanted to hear. Uh-huh. And then I think when I was 15, a friend of mine, I guess you could say I saved a friend of mine from being raped by another friend of mine, and that really caused me to start looking at things a bit differently, and I felt, like I said, an obligation to write more seriously. Mm-hmm. I guess that reminded me a lot of some of the very bad things that had happened to me, and felt like I was not fulfilling my duty just to keep those to myself. But it was time to share those with others and put them out there.
Mm-hmm. So when did you first publish?
I believe in high school I had a couple of things published in, you know, competitions for high school students. The very first poem that was published that where I considered myself a poet now, I believe was picked up by Southern Poetry Review. I was probably in my mid to late 20s.
Uh-huh.
I don't know that I'd really sought publication after high school until that point. Mm-hmm. I started to feel better about what I was writing, felt like it was actually decent stuff, and that it was fulfilling that obligation that that I felt I had.
Mm-hmm. So it was of some use.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Of use is a good way to put it.
Yeah. Well, let's hear a few poems.
All right.
What are you working on now?
What am I working on? Everything, constantly. I have, honestly, 4 manuscripts that... On any given day, I might consider them finished, and on any other given day, I plunge back into them, take poems out, add poems in. This is, I'll actually start with one. This is from probably the manuscript that I like the most, although I'm not sure that everyone else would. It's the more surreal of the manuscripts that I'm working on. It's tentatively titled Dreaming Out Loud.
Okay.
And the poem is called How Sounds Became Flowers, Flowers Turned to Faces. It's really based on a partial memory that didn't coalesce into a more complete memory until I was probably in my early 30s, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
The clanging chain of memory has finally swung to this, an empty playground, a broken seat twisting in wind, a sidewalk so shattered we could never miss every crack. I have never known where we were walking to, nor before what we were running from. You held my brothers, one in each arm. My hand was there, among the flowers of your shirt. I want to tell you he will hit you again. I want to scream, don't go back. I want to tell you to take us to your house of dreaming. Teach us the quiet ways of things. Voice that wraps its wings around you. Hand that can't stand its own closing. Touch that lies down inside you. I want to tell you some things hold you down only to keep you from floating through the ceiling. I know now how all this has led to your own soft dealing with everything, how each of your sons has found the world like a warm hand, a child wanting to be held. Going back, I would change nothing for me, but I would save you the pain of hands on faces, of memory clinging like something left loose inside you.
Hmm.
So there's that.
Yeah, and that's from what collection is that?
It's actually in what I hope to be a collection, like I said, tentatively called Dreaming Out Loud.
Dreaming Out Loud.
It was published just recently in a
an
anthology out of Hickory.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Nice. Nice piece.
Thank you.
Yeah.
That's,
What's the world of your poetry? Is it it's social, family,
I'm not sure I know how to answer that. The world of my poetry, I do think it varies from collection to collection. I think to some degree it varies from poem to poem. I have written a lot about my family of origin. I think in terms of political poetry, well, I guess from my perspective, all poetry is almost by definition political poetry, in as much as it's tackling things that matter. It's expressing a perspective that hopefully will matter in the world.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not overtly political. It's more subtly political. Mm-hmm.
Sure, a matter of witnessing or
right.
Right. Bringing to voice.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Yeah. Well, let's hear some more.
Okay. Let's see, where to go from here. We'll stay in childhood, I guess, and this is kind of a summation of the world that I grew up in.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of worlds, poem that comes out of the late 60s and early 70s. There are some personal experiences that are recorded here, as well as some more recognizable historical experiences. The riots at Attica, assassination of Martin Luther King, Kent State shootings, and My Lai from the Vietnam War.
Right.
It's called Breakings. There were always bottles in the well house, lined up on 2x4s, piled in boxes, hidden above the door. He hung them bottoms up on the sticks he planted in the pasture. Sometimes he used coffee cans, milk jugs, a red-lined slop jar, anything to make a noise as it swallowed the rocks or took the blows hard against its side. But nothing could match the sounds of shattered glass. Nothing could match the thrill of breaking. The changes came sudden but incomplete. What was once a bottle grew into the many faces of breaking. Mirrors and windows, stung running of cows, frantic beating of redbirds, cries of children. His father went off to war to practice breaking on other men. He became so good at it, he came back to teach others the black magic of breaking. His mother stayed home and broke water, broken husbands and children, broke her back to hold some fragment of family together. The old man, his grandfather, broke the earth, broke cows in the pasture, chicken bones in his teeth, taught him to break limbs with the red axe, the necks of chickens and rabbits, legs of owls and fox traps, skulls of cows in the stable. He saw the breaking of land, the endless bending of backs and knees, the big-handed breaking of his mother's face, his brother's mouth, his own shattered skin. He heard the news of breaking, of Attica and Kent, King and Mylai, the fields and jungles scattered with war, the streets emptied through breaking of walls and windows, hearts and heads. He saw the night shattered with noise and lights, a man's body broken open on the porch, the life splattered on the window, lying messy on the floor. He wanted to leave it all behind, to break the habits of breaking, but even now he knows the hearts of those he loves like glass. Another That's cheerful poem.
Well, no, you know, the poetry's sometimes not cheerful. It's okay. Yeah, a lot of history providing context there. Yeah, I remember that era very, very well myself.
And I think growing up as I did in a southern city that had already failed in a sense at agriculture and was well on its way to failing at industry, growing up in a poor, uneducated family with child abuse, it seemed like I was constantly looking for hope, I guess, mm-hmm. outside of that world, if you will. But the external world didn't seem to have a lot of hope at that point either. Anytime mm-hmm. you did see the news or hear the news, it was always violence.
Pretty rough, yeah. A rough era, yeah. So your home life, I gather, was not, what shall we say, warm and fuzzy.
Definitely not. I had, just to give you a sense, my parents at this point in their lives have had 13 divorces between the two of them. So there's a lot of transition time, let's say.
Wow.
And yeah. A couple of the stepfathers were physically abusive and biological father, not physically abusive, but he had his shortcomings as well, especially mm-hmm. on the emotional side of things.
Yeah, so, that's a lot to deal with as a young person, a young child, a boy, and then a young man.
Well, and I think again to use the word obligation, I think the fact that I managed to come through that relatively whole mm-hmm. is the source of that sense of obligation that I have. Mm-hmm. Kind of feel like I know that there are others out there who have gone through it or who are still going through it, and I'd like them to know that that there is hope and that mm-hmm. they're not alone. And,
indeed, right. So. Yeah.
But even with poems that don't deal with abuse, I still, you know, I don't know, just speaking for myself, I think there's always a sense of obligation behind any poem. There's something that you want to help the reader with, that mm-hmm. you want to give them a chance to feel something a little bit more deeply than they would otherwise. You want to give them a chance to think about something they might not otherwise have thought about. Mm-hmm. You just want to help them see something that they might not have seen otherwise. Mm-hmm. But that's just speaking for sure. myself. I'm not sure that every poet shares that
yeah,
same
well,
sense.
Right. There's some sense of shared perception a shared intuition of the world. Yeah.
I'm not sure why else we would write poetry.
Well, right. What's it for?
They're not paying us a whole lot for it, so.
Oh, yeah. Well, let's hear another poem or two.
Let's see. What do I have here? Let's go with something a little more hopeful. This is from The Fractured World. This was the collection that was published in August by Main Street Rag. And this is one of the poems that was nominated for a pushcart. It's a poem in two parts, and part one kind of details the moment at which I decided in my adulthood that it would actually be okay, finally, to be a father. And this was probably not until my mid-30s. Prior to that, I never felt like I had sufficient control over my own childhood demons, mm-hmm. I guess you would say.
Were you afraid you might replicate your own experience as a child?
I was afraid, right. I would just absolutely suck as a dad.
Yeah.
And I was afraid that at the least I would be the emotionally distant father that my father was, and at the worst I would be physically abusive.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard to imagine that changing one's mind about that happens in a single instant.
Mm-hmm.
But that seems pretty true to me. So yeah, anyway, that's the first part.
Yeah.
And the second part of the poem is kind of describes what I thought I would like to say to all the boys who were growing up as I did, mm-hmm. once I reached that realization. So the poem is called Foundings.
Okay.
One. The first time my stepson cried without his mother's hands to brush the pain away, I came to him quickly, without thinking. I touched him with almost a space between my flesh and his, the way a woman, aging and overweight, steps off a curb as if the path beneath her might not be real. And then he leaned into me, and my whole body changed into something I had not known existed. And what was once no part of me began to keep the ticking of our two wrists as one. Two. Every boy, too skinny, with a buzz cut and cheap worn-out shoes, with clothes clearly not bought but handed down, cautious and curious, hands keeping the safe distance of looking at everything, reminds me of the self I was and can never cease to be. Every time I see that unchanging shadow, I want to go up to him and shake him by the shoulders and say, "Boy, don't believe them. None of this should be feared. You have a right to everything." I think one reaction to a childhood similar to mine is to develop a habit of self-denial. It's always safer if you just stay back from everything, keep that reserve and mm-hmm. the distance that gives you.
Right.
And you know that you won't hurt others and you won't become the people that you don't want to be.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it takes a lot to let go of that. And I don't know, I wouldn't say that I've completely let go of that myself. I'm still, I made a comment about myself recently that I'm just too damn serious. And, mm-hmm. and I think that's largely the case. You know, I give a poetry reading and everyone seems kind of stunned after the poetry reading.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I need to lighten up, but I haven't mastered that yet.
Well, yeah, you know.
I'm not sure how you do that.
How does one do that exactly? I mean, some people have that gift for humor and for comedy. Or, you know, I think of Jonathan Williams, who is just wonderful at it, and others, myself, likewise. I struggle with that. So I understand where you are.
At some point, you just have to accept your personality and live with it.
Yeah, I mean, we are who we are.
Yeah.
Have you found personal work, counseling, things like that, useful to you?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Really, in my mid-30s was when I don't know, where I grew up, counseling was not something that people did.
Right.
So it took me a while to figure out that was even a possibility. So prior to my mid-30s, most of my counseling was sort of self-counseling and literary counseling.
Literary, sure, right. I mean, we do read.
Yeah, right. I could give Emerson
mm-hmm.
credit for saving my life in a lot of ways,
yeah.
but I think he his particularly Eastern approach to things helped maintain my sanity
mm-hmm.
When I didn't know where else to turn.
Right.
And then, in like I said, in my mid-30s, I found some other sources of help.
Mm-hmm.
And the writing, to be honest, even back when I was a teenager and had started to write about my own experiences, that gave me the opportunity to really objectify those experiences and look at them from the outside,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. which made them a bit easier to accept,
mm-hmm.
And I think a bit easier to control the consequences of.
Mm-hmm.
So all of that has played into getting to where I am today.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just 4 years ago, I became father of my first biological child.
Uh-huh.
And prior to all of that work, I don't think I ever would have been comfortable becoming that father.
So yeah,
it was very important that things happened. Yeah, you know, I became a father, if you will, at age 41, which is not common. But I think that's when I was ready to become a father.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
I have another poem here, actually. Yeah, speaking of being ready to become a father, this is a. This is one about a friend and former student of mine who thought that he was ready to be a father, and frankly, I thought he was ready to be a father, and things proved to be different. It's called Defending the Indefensible. My friend's mother calls to tell me he's in jail. She won't tell me why, though I guess the reason, and later confirm it with a police record search. Use of hands, feet, choking to unconsciousness. His father hit him often, without mercy. I think of the poem he read in class, his father bearing down, the belt across his back, for his own good. I think of my own days locked in closets, bloodied beneath the belt, the hand on the electric stove. None of this is meant to excuse him, but if I can remember, he's still a boy, on the wrong end of a short temper, of rage wrongly expressed. He might stand a chance of remembering himself. Understandably, I think we have a tendency to demonize abusers.
Right.
I know, certainly at times in my life, I've demonized those who abused me. We also have a tendency to demonize ourselves. Even if we don't lose control, just once we know that that's a potential, I think we run the risk of demonizing ourselves. And once you do that, I'm not sure that there's any hope. Once you follow that belief about yourself,
if you're self-demonized, it's really,
you may be lost. And,
and
so I think we all have to be careful to recognize that even abusers are still human beings, and to work with them. So, not asking for forgiveness. I'm not asking for, not asking people to look the other way. If anything, I want them to focus on it and really try to help these people. And the first step to that is reminding them of their humanity, not letting them lose a sense of that humanity.
So, insisting on their humanity.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Thank you. You're listening to Wordplay on WPDM 103.5 Asheville, North Carolina. I'm your host, Jeff Davis. With me today in the studio, Hickory poet Scott Owen. And Scott, you have a recent book out.
Right.
Yes. Yeah. Tell us a little bit about the recent work.
Well, The Fractured World is a book in three parts, by and large. It was published back in August by Main Street Rag. And
they're a busy house these days.
I'm sorry?
They're a busy house these days.
They are. I've been very impressed with the amount of work that Scott Douglas gets done.
Yeah.
It's impressive. The first part of the book, anyway, kind of presents the world out of which, well, actually, let me rephrase that. The world that is both cause and consequence of abusive parenting, let's say. The second part presents a character, Norman, who is both abuser and abused. And the final section presents what I hope is some hope for redemption, mm-hmm. For anyone in that situation. Now, not every poem in the book is dark and depressing. There are some that look at the world that's being described there in lighter terms, and so that we can change the mood a bit, I thought I would read one of those. It's not quite so heavy.
Okay, great.
This is called Norman's Enormous Thing, and this is a poem that simply started from liking to enjoying creating consonants, enjoying creating alliteration, and when you have a character named Norman, the first word that came to mind as creating that is enormous. So Norman's Enormous Thing. He thought if he could give it to her just once, he'd be rid of it forever. But no matter how he tried, it kept coming back, bigger, and always at the worst possible moment. At work, at parties, on crowded streets and buses, almost anywhere he came in contact with people, it would pop out, refusing to stay hidden, rubbing against those around him, pushing them aside. At home, it lay on top of everything, always tense and too big for his body. It sat erect at the table, hung over the chairs, covered the television, blocked the door, ready to rise up between them. Night after night he came to her, his hands full of himself, hanging from his body like a second head, bloated and mean. Night after night she gently punctured his bag of self-importance, releasing just enough air to breathe, to let him breathe again.
Yeah, some humor, but with an edge, too.
Yeah. I always thought of that as a fairly funny poem, I guess. And mm-hmm. then Tim Peeler wrote a review of the book after it had come out. Tim Peeler is another poet from Hickory.
Right, who's actually been on Wordplay.
Right. He was on not long ago.
Yeah.
And in the review, he commented how if you see Norman's Enormous Thing as the shadow of the wound, if mm-hmm. you will, then it you begin to see how it relates to the rest of the book more closely, and you can also see the poem as very sadly mm-hmm. humorous. Mm-hmm. So
that's a nice perception. Yeah,
it was. Yeah. I was, and actually, I love it when someone else adds a better interpretation to a poem of mine than I've ever seen.
Sure.
And it's happened on more than one occasion.
Yeah, we don't always see what's going on in our own poems, you know. Right.
We're very good at fooling ourselves.
Yeah. Yeah.
So let's see.
It's our job, in a way.
So I thought I'd read a couple of poems from my first book, which was published back in the mid-90s. And I'm actually using most of the poems from this book as the center, if you will, of a new manuscript. And the new manuscript mm-hmm. actually takes its title... looking to make sure I get this right. Yeah. Well, it takes its title from one of the poems in this book. This book is called The Persistence of Faith, and it was published by a now-defunct press, Sandstone. Mm-hmm. This is a poem called Looking for Faces in the Night Sky. These are things anyone could have made up. The stars are nothing but stars, and playing dot to dot in the night sky makes anything possible. Years ago, from the stone porch, my grandfather pointed them out, the lion, the great bear, the hunter's sword. This one he called Mary, and showed me how the stars made a woman's face. Looking for faces in the night sky, we string stars into shapes of things we fear or long to remember. I see spider, sparrowhawk, bob white. This one I'll call woman becoming an angel, the grotesque buds of wings sprouting in her back. And the poem's really an elegy for my grandmother, who had died shortly before writing the poem, and also a memory of my grandfather. Growing up, I had terrible insomnia. I would typically wake up at 3 or 4 in the morning and not be able to go back to sleep, and often I would just kind of get up and wander around the house. And one day, one summer, when I was staying at his house, woke up at, I believe it was 3 a.m., and was wandering around their house and realized that the front door was standing wide open. So I cautiously went to take a look, and there was my grandfather standing out on the front porch. Apparently, that's where I got the insomnia from. But he pointed out to me the constellations. So I thought. It took me many, many years later, when I actually started learning about the constellations, I discovered that he had made it all up.
He had his own constellations.
Exactly. And I enjoyed that habit so much that I wanted to get that into a poem.
That's nice. Yeah. Let's have another from this early work.
This is actually the last poem of the book, and the title of the new manuscript that I'm working on, as I indicated, comes from this poem. This one's called Common Ground, and definitely for my brother, as it becomes fairly clear early on. My brother has never kept a single lake, a single lost grave to himself. Always he calls, then waits till I can come, lets me lead the way, find it like the first time, shouting the names I know, the shapes of bird and stone, tree and fish. Once, in the same day, I saw a kestrel, a mantis, an arrowhead, and took it as a sign, though since I have seen each in their own days and miles away from each other. I do not believe God will bend to kiss this mouth. I do not believe the wine will turn. But something knows the moment of sunflower, the time of crow's open wing, the time of moss growing on rock and water washing it away. This is the faith I've wanted, to know that even now we are capable of such sacrifice, such willingness to love.
Yeah, nice piece.
Thank you.
Yeah, you've got a really clean line.
Well, thank
which
you.
Which is, yeah.
In terms of constructing the poems, I mean, I really like that comment, because often what happens in terms of constructing what I typically see as organic verse is I begin with a single line. There's I may write 30 lines, but there's one that stands out as this is, I want this one unit to be a line. And I'll then structure the rest of the lines around the length, the sound, the feel of that one line.
Mm-hmm. Right. Who are some poets whose work was helpful to you as you were forming your own style, as it were, your own approach to poetry?
Oh, early on, Robert Frost was the key. And, I wrote a lot of formal poetry up through my undergraduate days at Ohio University. And Robert Frost was always my model until I realized that my poems sounded way too much like Robert Frost and thought, I've got to move on from this. And then Walt Whitman served as a tutor on how to move away from
the
Frostian sound.
Yeah, right.
And then
the great groundbreaker, old Walt.
Oh, yeah. And then I think when my poetry really started, sounds kind of odd to say that, when my poetry started taking on a voice of its own was when I discovered Galway Canal. And, again, it sounds strange to say that it started taking on a voice of its own when I discovered a particular poet. But I do think that he showed me how to modernize Whitman, in a sense. And so those three, and there have been many other poets who have influenced what I'm doing and how I do it. But those three are kind of the Trinity, I suppose you'd say.
The big three.
The big three.
Right.
The big
right.
three. Not sure which one would be Father, Son, Holy Ghost. How would it work out? I think Whitman would have to be the Holy Ghost role, but beyond that, I'll leave the listener to puzzle out.
Right, right. Yeah, two New Englanders among those, and all three from the Northeast, actually. So, yeah, interesting.
Yeah, the thing that Frost did, probably like so many people coming out of a public school setting, most of the poets that I had read prior to Frost were very academic. Mm-hmm. You know, you can say that Wordsworth wrote from the perspective of the common people, but he was writing from the perspective of 19th century British people, so that mm-hmm. had nothing to do with me.
Right.
You could argue that, well, Frost was writing out of the perspective of early 20th century New England people, but that was somewhat closer to me, and I mm-hmm. could hear the voice of the common people mm-hmm. in his lines. And that was a big part of what I was trying to do, because my poems were coming out of a southern cotton mill town, mm-hmm. which I spent half my time growing up there, and a southern small farm, mm-hmm. which is where I spent the other half of my childhood.
Is Greenwood a mill town, basically?
Greenwood was a mill town.
Was a mill town, yeah, right. Probably no longer.
Right, no longer right. a mill town.
I don't think I've ever been there, though. I had... an English teacher who actually was from Greenwood.
Really?
Yeah, Mary Bawley. And she was fabulous, you know. But, yeah, had a very droll sense of humor. But I had no idea what her background was in terms of, you know, what sort of ambiance Greenwood presented.
I think if you come from Greenwood, then you're familiar with failure. Uh-huh. Not that I'm dissing Greenwood completely, but...
Sure.
You know, it has gone through several deaths, in a sense, and rebirths.
So. Like many southern towns,
right,
when the mills crashed. I mean, you know.
And most southern towns before the mills even existed were agricultural centers, and
right.
they crashed in that regard.
Right. Mm-hmm. The South is, I guess you could say, characterized by these sorts of economic dislocations.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let's see, what do we want to do next? Let's read, this is one, the manuscript that I'm working on, the title of which, by the way, is Something Knows the Moment, is one of those books that can get you into a lot of trouble with a lot of people, especially as a poet in the South. the poems are primarily, they take on religious themes, I guess you would say.
Yeah.
And they deal with... characters, stories that one would have experienced growing up in the South, which mm-hmm. You know, is pretty predictable. But they don't always take the typical perspective on those things. And this is a poem that I'm sure is going to get me in trouble at some point.
Yeah, that's the part that gets you into trouble, not taking right. the typical perspective.
Right. This is it's based on a George Tooker painting. He had a couple of paintings named Meadow. I believe this one is actually Meadow 2. And it's just an image of an old man and woman sitting in a meadow.
Mm-hmm.
And something about the painting when I first saw it reminded me so much of the stories of Mary and Joseph. And I don't know, the face of the old man in the painting really got me thinking about the story that we have from the perspective of Joseph, and what a bizarre experience that must have been, if we can ascribe any veracity
mm-hmm.
to it.
Mm-hmm.
So the poem is called Meadow, Met Mary and Joseph. Tired, dead tired, head ringing with unending questions. Here, beside the stone, in the shadow of these trees, lie down. Rest. I'll kneel beside you and wait. Who cropped this field, miles from anywhere? What hand, what foot cleared this path before us? What unfathered God lay down this road? Damned light, damned voices, damned city I go to for this unearthly making. How alone I feel, and betrayed, unwifed, unallowed to do what any man would do. No child to call my own, cuckold, outcast. Nothing but these strong-armed angels filling my head, pushing their happy consequence of miracles. What do they know of doubt, shame, emasculation? To be so chosen, stem of Jesse, rod of Abraham, am I reduced or risen? Father, son, and holy escort, chauffeur with donkey, steward to God's great anomaly, seedless, fruitless bearer of this living cross. Will I hold him? Will I cry at his inevitable hanging? What father will he cry out for? Unborn prince of unlikely blood, playing insane games of a Greek god, what heavenly bliss will this bring me? Yours is not the only sacrifice to be made here. What manhood, what life, what father's hand is severed and replaced? Sweet angelic face, near death in this quiet perfection, you can't imagine the doubts I've had. What hands are these to tear and rend? Some things weigh heavier only because they have to. How much these eyes can't see. Rest, rest, rest.
Yeah. Very nice. Yeah. Thank interesting you. Use of that story, you know, of the biblical story. Yeah. Yeah. Huh. I don't know his painting. I'm going to have to look it up and see what's out there on the web, I guess, yeah. To see.
Tucker's a fantastic artist who, I don't know, doesn't seem to be taught as much in the schools as other American artists, mm-hmm. but hopefully his reputation will stick around for a while.
Yeah, yeah. Do you do much work from paintings or from, you know, images otherwise?
Kind of off and on. I'll go through... A period where I'll be struck by a particular artist and want to write poems on what I see. And mm-hmm. other times there are opportunities, if you will, for exhibits, creating ekphrastic poetry, mm-hmm. Exhibiting poetry next to the art. In fact, we recently had that same situation in Hickory. Mm-hmm. There's an annual fundraising event called the Aroma of Art, and local artists donate their work to be mm-hmm. auctioned off, and the proceeds go to three different very worthwhile nonprofits in the area. Mm-hmm. And they asked me last year if I would, they decided to do some poetry mm-hmm. as the entertainment part of it. Mm-hmm. And so we put together an ekphrastic exhibit and an ekphrastic reading. It was very nice, except that a lot of the people who come to the auction aren't expecting to sit there and listen to poetry. So this year we kind of...
Heaven forbid.
Right. This year we set it up as two different related events, and uh-huh. we had the exhibit and the reading prior to the final auction.
Good. So those who actually wanted to hear the reading exactly. could be there yeah. and yeah. otherwise not.
Yeah, the auction crowd is not quite the same as the poetry reading crowd.
Right? No, right, but. Right. Some overlap perhaps, but yeah. yeah. 10% maybe. Yeah.
Let's see.
Yeah.
What do we want to do from here?
Yeah. Well, find another poem.
Let's read something new and totally unrelated to anything else. Okay. Although, actually, this is related
of
to
course.
Something I said.
Of course.
to something I said earlier about being too serious. And there are a lot of other poets who have contributed to this poem, I guess, right from the title, which everyone will recognize as having been shamelessly stolen from William Carlos Williams. I think it also echoes a bit of Eliot's The Wasteland and a bit of Cummings as well.
That's an interesting yeah. trio right there.
but the poem is, I wrote this actually, I believe, last week, sitting in a little garden at the CVCC where I teach, mm-hmm. and it's called Spring and All.
Oh, yes.
Sorry, William. He finds a cage for comfort in a quiet garden, iron gate, railings, pent up in a corner, back against the wall. So serious, even outside, in spring, when girls are laughing and wanting to be kissed. He sees the chaos of yellow bells blooming the length of branches, hears a cacophony of birds, smells the sweet seduction of rosemary. It makes him smile a little, thoughtful, intense, satisfied with renewal. But nothing overflows. It never does. He wonders what went wrong to make his passion so frail.
Listening to Wordplay, I'm your host, Jeff Davis, and you're listening, of course, on WPVM 103.5 Asheville, North Carolina. With me in the studios today, poet Scott Owens, and we've been listening to some really, really fine work. So, yeah, nice stuff.
Well, thank you.
Yeah,
I appreciate you having me up here. This is a great day to be in Asheville.
Yeah.
I was telling you before the show that I have the best luck when it comes to coming to Asheville, because every time I've been here, which is probably a dozen times, mm-hmm. it's perfect weather.
Mm-hmm. We have to have you over more often, then.
The good luck weather charm.
Yeah, yeah. Let's hear some more poems.
All right, sure. I had mentioned earlier that my life really changed about 4 years ago when my daughter was born. At the age of 41, becoming a mm-hmm. father.
It's transforming, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And this is a poem. I want to keep it light for a moment longer. This poem also refers to my favorite haunt, if you will, Tasteful Beans Coffee House in downtown Hickory.
Mm-hmm. Very nice place.
Thank you.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Sawyer, my daughter's name is Sawyer, and she and I, for the first couple of years, really, of her life, we took a daily walk from where we lived up to the coffee house.
Mm-hmm.
We would sit and drink coffee, or I would drink coffee,
mm-hmm.
not giving her caffeine at that age.
Right.
And and then we'd walk back home. So we became very, very well known in the place. And it's also the place that we hold the Poetry Hickory readings, mm-hmm. which is how Jeff knows about it,
right,
having given a reading as part of that.
Yeah.
Well, this describes one of the moments at which I realized just how much my life had changed. And the title is A Brush with Reality in the Form of a Toyota Sienna, which, of course, is mm-hmm. Toyota's minivan.
Mm-hmm.
The high-maintenance girls run by my minivan, fuel-efficient, 8-seated, 15-cup-holdered, easily cleaned conveyance as I balance keys, cell phone, and morning cup of coffee, a venti breve latte with shots of Irish cream and creme de cacao. A Becky's Mozart, they call it at Tasteful, two words. Beans Coffee House, one word, the owner reminds me again. I wonder at the price of plastic and lycra, at hands that make the shape of perfect cups, only bigger. I hear their voices, watch the bounce of tight ponytails, smell obsession, even this time of day, even while jogging, and, carried away by sensual delight, I imagine they might speak to me. Siren-voiced, Circe-eyed muses of beauty, arousing a moment's inspiration, until I notice the dampness from the dew-wet door has soaked through the cotton poly-blend shirt covering the flaccid flesh of my slightly protruding middle-aged paunch. And then, even my hatchback magnet proclaiming, "Real men drive minivans," is not enough to convince me they care at all for my domesticity.
Yeah.
Nothing more humbling than driving a minivan, I don't think.
I know. I drive one too, so still.
There you go. And I wanted to stick with my daughter for a moment. When I was supposed to come up and be on your show in January, my mother-in-law, who had been stricken with ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease, for several months, took a very sharp turn for the worse, and so we had to reschedule.
Right.
And she did actually pass away January 13th. Oh, so.
Yeah, sorry to hear that.
Afterwards, a lot of my conversations with my daughter dealt with her grandmother passing away, and sure. She constantly surprised me with some of the things that she said. And most of this poem actually consists of her words. And the poem is simply called Theology. "There's only one problem with God," she says, as earnest at three as all my years of faith and disbelief. "God can't talk. So if you have to ask him a question, he won't answer." I know the question she means, the one about Grandma I never answer well enough. "If you give him something, he won't say thank you or ever give it back." I'm amazed at youthful understanding of manners and expectation, her grasp of tyranny that comes without condition. "If you tell him I love you, he won't say he loves you too."
Insights.
Yeah, from a three-year-old. She kind of blew me away with some of that, and still don't know how to satisfactorily answer her questions.
Yeah, she raises some real issues at the heart of religion. Did religion mean a lot to you as you were growing up? Was it?
You know, it's a funny thing. Growing up in the South the way I did, you would think that my family would have gone to church all the time, but they actually never did.
No, they didn't.
For me, I was always looking for answers. And so I can remember at the age of five getting myself up on Sunday morning and going out to catch the church bus by myself.
Wow.
And, you know, I proceeded probably until I was around 13 or 14 to go from one church to another looking for consistent answers and being constantly disappointed with the lack of consistency.
Right.
And I guess it was about 14 that I discovered Emerson and several other writers and felt more consistency. Not necessarily that that it was an accurate perception at the time, but it was very useful to me. So,
but they met that need.
They did.
Yeah,
they did.
Better so, than,
Religion was very important to me, and it continues to be very important to me. I continue to seek for broader answers, more meaningful answers. And so, yeah, it definitely has played a role. This is, let's see, how many more poems do you want to read?
A couple. I would like to talk about the Sam Regan Prize and Poetry Hickory a bit, too. But
all right, let me read, I want to hold on to that one for just a second. I always like to close with something like that. Let me read, let's see if I can find it now. Yeah, here we go. This is another manuscript that I would say is complete. I've sent it out to a couple of competitions. It's a very interesting manuscript. It's a collaborative effort with a poet from Florida named Pris Campbell. And the collaboration started in a bizarre way. She had actually seen the poem Norman's Enormous Thing online and liked it. and she felt from that poem and some others that she had seen that I might be able to write poems in response to some of hers.
Mm-hmm.
And so she sent me a batch of poems and asked if I would do so, and I looked over the poems and realized writing responses to those would really ruin what she had created. Mm-hmm. She had created a fine book of poetry. And so I told her, you need to just write a couple more poems in this and bundle it up and send it out. She did so, and that book has now been published. Mm-hmm. It's called Hesitant Commitments from Lummox Press.
Hmm. Okay.
But not long after that, she made a comment spinning off of Norman's Enormous Thing that caused me to want to write another poem related to it. So I wrote that poem and sent it to her, and then she wrote a poem spinning off of my poem, and we started going back and forth and created the series of poems about our relationship, in which Norman was one of the characters and a character of hers named Sarah was the other. And that book is, or that manuscript is now being shopped around, so hopefully it'll come out shortly. And this is one of the poems from that manuscript. This is a poem that treats Norman a bit more favorably than most of the poems in The Fractured World. In this one, Norman comes to a bit of self-realization and mm-hmm. makes a decision. It's called The Day He Left.
Big step. All right. Yeah.
Excuse me. Norman tried. No one could fault him with not trying. He never hit her, not once in 3 years, not even after the boy came at first. Though he felt the father within him rising every day, trying to disgorge itself across the bed, the table, the faces of those he loved. And then the day came when his head hurt, and it was too hot outside, and things had gone wrong all day, and the boy was suddenly louder than he wanted him to be, and his hand shot out just ahead of memory, screaming, "No!" And then shot out again in a trail of resignation when she came to his side. Sarah stayed. He knew she would, at least for now, soul that fought hard against giving up. But he knew it wouldn't last, having tasted once the ease of the familiar, like any addict, he knew he'd do it again. Years later, old and alone, he'd see it as his one success, the woman he almost loved the day he left. And, here it is.
Yeah.
I always, not always, I like to say sometimes that so many poems deal with death, and since it is the end, or we like to think of it as the end anyway, sometimes, that every poetry reading should end with death as well. So this is my death poem du jour. It's called The Hard Way. I want to take a long time to die, like a seal on a beach in California, each rib showing through skin grown thin, not welcoming water or birds, but fighting to keep my head up, teeth bared. The summer, you gave in to bloated skin, shame, anger, calamity of living with a woman who always wanted too much. I decided I'd never make it easy on anyone. Pen in hand, arthritic and tight as a claw, eyes refusing to close, teeth clenched on anything that rose, unshaving, smelling of piss, fighting for one more step, one more breath. I want to sit at my desk and write down the last thing I see in stubborn and gorgeous detail, the last pain I feel, the last conscious thought, and then one more. There's a reference in the middle of that poem to my uncle who committed suicide when I was 19.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then one more.
And then
indeed.
One more.
Right. Well, how long has Poetry Hickory been rolling along?
We just had our 19th reading. Mm-hmm. We do them once a month on the first Tuesday of each month. And we usually have two featured writers. Mm-hmm. The whole series began, I'd mentioned Tim Peeler earlier, the mm-hmm. whole series really began because I had been a fan of Tim Peeler's poetry since the mid-90s.
Mm-hmm.
And from the mid-90s until 2005 or so, I had kind of taken a break from poetry. Uh-huh. When I discovered that Tim Peeler was at CVCC, still teaching and still writing, and seemed like no one I knew in Hickory knew about him, I thought, this is just a travesty.
Yeah.
They need to know
pretty crazy.
Who is here.
Yeah.
So I kind of created Poetry Hickory to give people like Tim Peeler an opportunity to show what they had.
Yeah.
And it's really taken off from there. We've had every Hickory poet that I can think of mm-hmm. read, but we've also had a lot of
out-of-towners. Yeah, yeah. Right.
You came down. We've had Irene Honeycutt recently, Chuck Sullivan, Danny Romine Powell. Mm-hmm. We're going to have April's going to be a big month. Carter Monroe uh-huh. is coming, uh-huh. and Ted Pope.
Oh, Ted's going to
I know Ted's been on your show.
And yeah, Ted has.
You read with Ted at the Black Mountain.
Right. The festival in September. And, yeah, yeah. Yeah. Right.
So
and I'm a member of the Ted Pope fan club on Facebook.
do you know what your title as a member of the fan club is?
Not at the moment. Yeah, I can't. Yeah.
I think Tim Peeler's the one who's coming up with those titles.
Right.
He's having a lot of fun with them.
Yeah, yeah. You're also managing the Sam Reagan Prize this year?
Right, with the Poetry Council of North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't mind, I'll sneak in a quick plug for that. If you need information on the Sam Reagan Prize, you can go to www.oldmp.com, and that's the Poetry Council website. .com/Poetry Council of NC.
Okay.
Or you can go to my website, scottowenspoet.com, and there's a link there as well.
There you go.
But this is a competition that's open to North Carolina high school students and mm-hmm. undergraduates under the age of 22. If you're
mm-hmm.
once you get to be too old, we figure you need to enter one of the adult competitions.
Right.
So by all means, look it up and send me some poems.
Sounds great. Thanks so much, Scott, for coming in today. And that's Wordplay for this week. Tune in again next Sunday for